This is Block by Block, a community news program where we explore issues affecting the Philadelphia area with news reports from members of the community. I'm Sophia Mattia.
And I'm Abby Cruz. In the next half hour, we'll hear stories from our community news reporters about the importance of diversity among archivists and research librarians, a new Yemeni-style coffee shop in West Philly, and a Northwest Philly nonprofit that connects people with nature for wellness and educational purposes.
But first, the internet has come a long way in the past 30 years. Now you can make video calls to anyone in the world from your phone, download large files in seconds, or stream 4K movies to your TV. But a handful of big tech companies also now control a huge portion of the internet. So a group of Philadelphians is trying to bring back some of the old internet by contributing to a web that's slower, handmade, and free from algorithms and AI. Block by Block reporter Milan Parker brings us this story.
Every month, the Indie Web Homebrew Club gathers at Iffy Books at 20th and Pine to do something most people stopped doing decades ago, build their own websites by hand. And if they're not building, they're sharing tips, linking back to each other's pages, and imagining an internet that looks a lot more like 1999 than 2026. The club is part of an international indie web community, and it was founded by web developer Zephyr Pruzinski, who moved from New York to Philadelphia 4 years ago. But despite making websites for a living, he didn't always have one of his own.
You know, I sort of relied on social media platforms. And, you know, maybe I had like a portfolio website when I was looking for jobs. But I there was a while there that I didn't really consider having my own presence on the web as sort of, like showing who I am. And I was introduced to the indie web through a coworker. It really, you know, like struck a chord with me. It's all of these social media platforms. There's a real cost to them being free in that they're, you know, making money off of your data and, you know, selling it to ad platforms. And so having your own place on the internet, you control what your presence looks like. And, you know, you can back up your own data. And that's really big because there's no social media platform that I know of that lets you take your data back and move it somewhere else if you need to.
Now, Zephyr has a simple website where he posts a little information about himself, photos of his hydroponic garden, and occasional blog posts. It has a basic, text-heavy layout with a few pictures. The website loads quickly, and it has no ads or trackers. While he lived in New York, Zephyr regularly attended hacker meetups and indie web events. But when he couldn't find any in Philly, he decided to form the Indie Web Homebrew Club, which has been meeting once a month at Iffy Books since last summer. Members show up with their laptops, work on their own sites, and help each other troubleshoot everything from layout problems to broken code. He says people who attend come for many reasons, but something they have in common is that they're looking for something they can't get from social media.
There's a lot of folks that are either new to programming as a whole, or, you know, maybe they just have something they want to put out there, or they have control over how it's presented. You know, I've met folks that are, you know, digital artists, and they want a website that's sort of a portfolio of what they're doing. And like, it's also people that are looking to get away from, you know, social media as a construct, or at least, you know, having like a central hub. A lot of social media is like really based around the loop of reactions and posting something that will like keep someone looking at your content for a very long time. But there's something kind of powerful about just posting it for whatever. Maybe it'll help someone else. Maybe, you know, someone will be interested about what you're doing.
So what exactly is the indie web? For some, it's a creative outlet and a sense of community. For others, it's about carving out a corner of the internet outside of the algorithms that shape Facebook, Instagram, X formerly known as Twitter, and YouTube. And increasingly, for many people, it's about pushing back against AI and a web where chatbots and AI assistants seem impossible to avoid, even in a basic Google search. Steve McLaughlin opened Iffy Books in 2021, and has made the small shop a place where customers can find books and zines on hacking, gardening, and DIY culture. He says he knows exactly why people are trying to reclaim the spirit of the early internet.
Often, the best information on the topic you're trying to research was on a GeoCities page. Like, you'd be interested in, like, I don't know, you see an actor on a TV show or something. Like, I'm curious about Jason Priestley. So you do a web search, and then you get to somebody's carefully curated GeoCities page with, like, scans of magazine photos and transcripts of interviews and all kinds of information. Just like sort of self-designated people would become the authority on some particular thing. So yeah, some of these websites become very big and popular and influential just being run by one person on GeoCities.
Joining the Indie Web Homebrew Club's monthly meetings is one way to bring a bit of the spirit back. But you could also just sign up for a Build Your Own Website workshop. Software engineer Richard Green hosts a monthly workshop at Iffy Books where people learn to build their own websites using NeoCities, a free hosting platform modeled after the old GeoCities, where anyone can build and publish a website by hand.
I'm not a big fan of the way the internet has gone over the years, and I see this as a way to give back, teach people how to reclaim their digital lives.
Richard says his workshops draw a mix of people.
There's people that have never done anything like this before, who just thought it was cool or get dragged here by a friend. There's people who are professional software engineers who just came because they wanted to check it out. Maybe they had a Tumblr site back in the day, or yeah, some people who've had like a GeoCities site in the past. I think people think of it as a difficult thing that they couldn't ever possibly do, right? Like, I'm not good with computers, or I'm not a genius, whatever, right? At least getting started with it, I think, is a lot easier than people think. Like, in 2 hours, you get a website. It's not going to look that great at the beginning, right? But you can keep building on it. People come in who've never done any of this before and come out excited about it.
Most people who walk into Iffy Books to become part of the Philadelphia indie web community, from what I've witnessed, are guided by a sense of hopefulness about the future. Maybe we'll never get rid of AI-generated Google searches that are wrong about half of the time. And maybe that dancing baby gif deserves to stay stuck in 1999. But as Iffy Books owner Steve says, the people who come through the door are drawn by a desire to bring back one of the best parts of the early web.
It was very exciting, and it was a real time of optimism, really. I mean, it was incredible to be able to read newspapers from around the world and chat with people from different places and different backgrounds. That optimism in the culture lasted for a long time, and then sometime in the 2010s, it started to curdle. People turned against the tech industry. But I'm remembering the good parts of technology and, like, in a way, trying to help people get back to some of those more, like, idealistic ideas that were floating around in the early internet.
For Block by Block, I'm Alon Parker.
Reference librarians and archivists are the keepers of cultural history, but most of the people working in this space in the United States are white, and that can impact the way we understand our history. Block by Block reporter Tafari Robertson brings us the story of one Black archivist and the challenges they face and work to overcome.
My name is Ainsley Wynn Akins. Most people call me Wynn, except for my family, and I work at the Library Company of Philadelphia right now, as well as at Paul Robeson House.
Wynn is an archivist and a reference librarian. Their passion started early with a grandma who worked as a public school librarian in North Carolina and Virginia for over 40 years.
I just remember being in that library all the time as a toddler, just running around her shelves, and she'd buy me or bring home, let me check out, you know, a bunch of really beautiful illustrated books. And I think books were a passion of mine because of that.
They went on to major in Black Studies at Wesleyan University after a chance leg injury led them to take courses at the department that was nearest to their dorms.
One of their mottos was that African-American history is enough. You know, you don't have to double major. You don't have to only make it a minor. You know, you can major in this, and that knowledge is enough. And it really was, because it is world history, but just from a really particular perspective.
They got their first experience archiving through an internship at Yale's Program for Recovery and Community Health, where they worked with a team of researchers uncovering a family's history of generational psychiatric incarceration.
We were looking through different state archive records and probate courts, trying to really dig up this history that had been hidden and intentionally erased by the state. And that was kind of my first foray into the world of archives, like on the ground, finding that history.
Navigating complex, untold histories is routine for archivists and researchers like Wynn. They're entering at the ground zero of sometimes painful and traumatic stories and creating organized systems for finding the information that goes on to become the books and media we learn from. However, the field of historic preservation is led predominantly by middle-class white women. Though many of those archivists and librarians do important work, according to the 2024 U.S. Census, less than 5% of employed archivists were Black. And Wynn says that matters because Black workers bring different perspectives and understanding to the work.
Whether it's folks from the continent, folks from the Caribbean, African-American folks here. There are just different levels of listening and interpretation that I'm able to do that help me move through various catalogs or various collections and identify like really precisely, like this is the thing that you're looking for. This is a part of the story. This is the example.
This layer of the work is essential to helping anyone interested in learning about the histories of marginalized people. But for this same reason, it often goes unseen. The extra care and attention to detail can be taken for granted or treated as an invisible benefit rather than a refined skill set.
There are many times where I know I'm providing excellent service, like reference service to my patrons, both in the archives and the library, wherever. But then you also have people looking down at you and just not giving you the responsibilities that you know you can handle or not treating you like you're a regular member of the staff or just belittling me, you know, sort of at various turns.
Eventually, the frustrations of being overlooked led Wynn to resign from the library company. They found a new position with an independent nonprofit dedicated to building a local prison archive. Akins has incarcerated family members. So working with this organization felt like an opportunity to serve their community in a more direct and meaningful way.
What if there's someone like me who, like, their father was incarcerated for a long time and passed away and they didn't really get to talk to them or, like, know them or their voice? If we're doing these oral histories, like, what would a family member want to hear?
What initially seemed more fulfilling turned out to be less about developing a sustainable preservation project and more interested in creating content ready for the interests of potential funders, disregarding the work Akins was both skilled in and passionate about.
It's probably one of the worst jobs that I've ever had. You know, I was verbally assaulted at that job. I was heavily disrespected. And the end product of that, they didn't want it to be archival, actually. They just wanted a website that could show that they deserve more money, you know, from these huge grant funders. So it's a lot of weird sides of the same coin.
After this experience, they returned to the library company, but continued to work within the incarcerated community as a volunteer instead. Taking on this sort of responsibility when working within marginalized communities is historically not the default, but it is a growing movement. As excitement for cultural preservation reaches new generations, opportunities for professional work are often gatekept.
There's a lot of other people in the same boat. Like, I don't think my experience is really unique at all, but a lot of folks who do the training or try to do the training that we're told that we need to have a career, have stability, and because of how we look or how we dress or our sexuality or our age, whatever, our hair, you know, we're not treated as we should be. We're not given the opportunities that we deserve, no matter how much sort of training we do.
And yet, when given the opportunity, Wynn says Black archivists and librarians can have a major impact on the spaces they work in and the future of the field.
We're not just doing the professional standard. We're also doing care work and doing this kind of trauma and healing informed work. And also trying to be, you know, digital technologists and working with digital humanities and make things more accessible.
For Block by Block, this has been Tafari Robertson.
Several Yemeni-style coffee shops have opened in Philly over the last few years, providing gathering places for immigrant and Muslim communities and serving dessert and hot beverages until late at night, long after most other coffee shops in the city are closed. Casey Ruka recently visited one of the newest Yemeni-style cafes in the city to find out what makes these places special.
Shabam Coffee is a cafe franchise based in Dearborn, Michigan that has expanded to more than a dozen cities across the country. Their newest location in West Philly was opened up by four friends, Fahad Azam, Kuram Gayas, Wakas Gayas, and Roshan Ahmad. When I met with Fahad at Shabam recently, he told me each of the co-owners brings a different skill set to the table.
I'm mainly responsible for social media, online marketing, Horam has a lot of background with construction, and Waqas has managed a team before, so he has people management skills, and Roshan is our finance guy. He handles mostly HR and finance. And honestly, it was Horam's idea to kind of, you know, open up a coffee shop. So he's basically the link between all four of us, kind of like the glue that brought us all together.
Like the other Shabam cafes around the country, the Philly location offers an authentic Yemeni coffee and tea selection infused with spices and flavors like cardamom, ginger, and cinnamon, as well as espresso-based specialty drinks such as pistachio and date lattes. When it comes to their food, Shabam Philly partners with local businesses like Old City's Aroma Bakery for sweet treats, like their distinct and colorful fruit-shaped pastries.
A lot of our bakery, our savory items, we either make them in-house, like our sandwiches are made in-house, and we partner with local Philadelphia bakeries to bring also that Philadelphia touch into our space here. So it's a good combination of, you know, Yemeni coffee with the Philadelphia touch into it.
Another Shabam staple is the Yemeni honeycomb bread.
It's a traditional Yemeni dish. Essentially, it's a bread that's stuffed with cream cheese. You warm it up and then you drizzle honey on top of it. And yeah, we've been getting amazing feedback on that.
Walking around the cafe, the interior is very sleek and modern with white and gold decor, warm lighting, and marble top tables with cushioned chairs. The cafe also has a lounge area that is tucked away with roomy couches facing the windows, which let in a lot of natural light into the space when I visited. Like other Yemeni-style cafes, the owners of Shabam are not afraid to challenge norms in cafe culture in the U.S., especially when it comes to operating hours. While many coffee shops and tea houses cater to breakfast and lunch crowds and close by dinner time, during the month of Ramadan, Shabam opened from 3 p.m. to midnight. Since then, they have switched to a schedule of opening at 6 a.m. to 10 p.m. on weekdays and closing at midnight on weekends. Unlike in the U.S., where people are often grabbing coffee to go in a rush to get to work, in Yemeni culture, a coffee or tea is enjoyed to its fullest extent. In fact, Yemen historically popularized the concept of a coffee house as a hub for social life, which ended up spreading across the Middle East and beyond to Europe. Coffee houses became spaces for people to come together, have discussions and intellectual exchanges, play games, and enjoy their beverages. And while Shabam is popular amongst Muslim and Arab communities, the cafe's extended hours and location in University City have also been appealing to other members of the community, like students and healthcare workers. Fahad wants to see more local businesses have late night hours.
Yeah, the feedback we've been getting is, hey, Philadelphia shuts down at 8 p.m., 9 p.m. We need places to be open late. And hopefully, you know, this starts a trend within Philadelphia because we love, you know, the atmosphere, the ambience that we create here. Our customers love it, and we want other businesses to kind of follow suit.
The atmosphere at Shabam is one that encourages customers to hang out for as long as they want and is an enticing late-night alternative to hanging out in a bar for those who do not drink. The owners also envision Shabam as community-centered, leaning into the idea of cafes as a third space.
My whole intention is to, you know, not treat this just like a coffee shop. This is more of a community center, and that's been our goal from day one. We've done numerous events already. We've had an Eid bazaar. We've done promos targeting, you know, healthcare workers. We want to do live music. We're open to anyone and everybody. If you are an organization, whether you're a student organization or you're a professional organization, we're willing to work with you, collaborate with you. This is an open space for anyone and everyone.
Shabam Coffee is just one of several Yemeni-style cafes to open in Philly over the past few years. Haraz Coffee House is only a 15-minute walk from Shabam, and there's already a second Haraz in Fishtown now. Another cafe, called Muslims of the World, opened a location at 21st and Market in February. And this month, Kawa House is set to open a location in Old City. Fahad says he's not worried about the competition. In fact, he's excited to see those other cafes succeed.
Philadelphia, I think, is still catching up to some of the other bigger cities. And I think there's space for, you know, many more to come. I think it's only going to benefit the entire coffee culture to have all these spots opening up. I think it's beautiful.
For Block by Block, this is Casey Ruka.
When you live in a city like Philadelphia, you might think it'd be hard to find places to connect with nature, animals, and farmland. But there's an organization in Northwest Philadelphia that offers all three through community building, educational programs, and goats. My co-host, Sophia Mattia, brings us this story.
Philly Goat Project is located on a 16-acre farm inside of Aubrey Arboretum in Germantown. Karen Krivet founded the nonprofit in 2018 because she wanted to bring wellness and community to people experiencing hardship.
I was working in the community for 30 years as a social worker, working with families who were affected by gun violence, isolation, depression, lack of services for generations in communities that didn't have a lot of resources. And there's so much research about nature-based community spaces where people can avail themselves of walking, which is free, and gardening, which is free, and connecting with animals, which for the most part is free. And I wanted to create a medium that was accessible and free in a community that it would make a difference.
But why did she choose goats specifically?
Goats are very much like people. They can be super kind and super brutal at the same time. So there's a lot of family dynamics that you can see. And it happens quickly, like when we have a school visit or a therapeutic visit. After an hour, people really feel like they got to know their goat.
Philly Goat Project offers several main programs, which all have themes of therapeutic release and group wellness. Development coordinator Glenna Walsh started out as a Philly Goat Project volunteer before joining the staff. She says the work they do fills a special need.
We need connection. We need safe spaces to gather outside. We need something that sparks joy, something that gets people engaged with nature in a way that's not just observing but participating.
Philly Goat Project offers educational programming, where staff take some of the group's 13 goats on field trips to visit local schools and libraries. Each goat is named after a famous and impactful Philadelphian. The staff use the goats to help teach math and science. For example, founder Karen says students can see up close how goats digest food differently from humans.
What they're doing now is chewing their cud. And goats are such great animals to teach about science and nature because they have a four-chambered stomach and they're human size, kid size. So you can actually watch them digest their food. You can feel the first stomach that the food goes in is always really hard on the left side, and the stomach on the right side is really soft. So you can put your ear against their stomach and hear it rumbling.
They also teach literacy and prompt students to write poems about the goats that they see. Philly Goat Project Director of Operations Leslie Jackson shared a poem that a student wrote about the herd lead, Ivy.
Ivy looks like milk with pieces of chocolate. Ivy has a strawberry starburst tongue, built like an oval rabbit. Ears like folded rubber. Icy sky blue eyes. Ivy was like a pregnant woman, exhausted, chill and sassy.
The goats also learn tricks that they perform in interactive plays.
Circle, circle. Now, Ivy, instead of laying down, Ivy likes to jump on my back. Ivy, lay down. Lay down. Good girl. Kiss, kiss. Thank you.
And the plays are also Philly-themed. One titled Philly Goats Gruff is based on the Three Billy Goats Gruff.
It's all Philly references, so the grass tasted like cheesesteaks, the brambles tasted like soft pretzels, and the water tasted like cherry water ice. It was incredible.
While goats are at the center of Philly Goat Project, there are also two community gardens, a neighborhood family garden and a grief garden. Raquel Ramser-Webb is Philly Goat Project's neighborhood family garden director.
We have 27 adult gardeners, and they bring with them around 18 children. So we have a big group of gardeners. We are a collective community garden, meaning that we garden together, we talk, we have shared harvest meals together, we have yoga sessions together, we forage together, and more. We do a lot of amazing things together.
While the family garden brings neighbors together to grow and share food, the Philly Goat Project's Grief Garden provides a quiet space to process their feelings in a natural setting. It's open to the public 7 days a week, and it's the only grief garden in Philadelphia that is this accessible. Visitors can also participate in private grief walks with the goats. Philly Goat Project founder Karen Krivitz says the garden is also interactive, allowing visitors to process their grief in different ways.
There's a little mailbox that has like the tools for the interactive thing. So one of the things you can do is write a note that has the words that you wish you would have said and make it into a little scroll and tuck it into the wall of remembrance.
Karen says that Philly Goat Project also worked with artist Kate Swan, who designed a three-dimensional art piece made of excavated tree roots for the grief garden. The structure is meant to demonstrate that you never know about the grief that other people are carrying, but it also unearths the grief that is hidden, allowing it to exist out in the open. It's meant to be a way of grounding and returning to nature to combat the instability that grief brings.
It looks like some kind of wild starfish constellation, and they're intertwined like a wall that's kind of like a braided fabric with vines and different kinds of trees. And it's porous, but you see them in a way that you normally don't have a chance to reckon with, the intricacies of roots.
Karen says one of the most special qualities about the grief garden is that it's located right next to the goat paddocks.
It's kind of like grief. Grief inserts itself in your life. In the middle of everything, no matter what you're doing or who your people are, there's always grief to contend with.
The Philly Goat Project does a lot of things, but there's a common thread that ties together the community gardens and educational and wellness programs, and that's that spending time in nature can have positive benefits for mental health. And as the Philly Goat Project has grown, it's also helped form a sense of community for people in Northwest Philly to visit and help tend the gardens and even get to know all 13 goats by name. For Block by Block, I'm Sophia Mattia. Block by Block is produced by Amadi Braxton, Anaya Davis, Ahmed Hasuna, Cheryl Jones, Charlie Klein, Corinne Martin, Malam Parker, Donya Ramadan, Tafari Robertson, and us,
Abby Cruz,
and Sophia Mattia. Charlie Klein is our board operator tonight.
Brad Linder is Radio News Managing Editor for WPPM. Peta Liu is Radio Operations Manager, and Allison Durham is WPPM's Radio Program Manager.
We'll be back in 2 weeks with a new episode of Block by Block, featuring more stories about issues affecting life in the Philly region. And you can find past episodes of the show on PhillyCam's SoundCloud, Apple Podcasts, and wherever else you find your podcasts.
Thanks for listening!